No, that 3:30, I'm testifying in Senate healthcare.
Right, she's going to pop out at 3:30, Representative Parrish's.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for May 11th. Hooray, hooray, it's the 11th of May. And we'll open up a...
What begins today?
A work session, I think, huh?
Correct.
A work session on Senate Bill 31. And we'll ask its sponsor to see if he can explain it to us. We got a little lost in the grass, covered with cremains in the last session. And if you could help us out of that dilemma, it would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, I think, though, if we ended up in the weeds, we were okay, right?
Yeah, the weeds are fine.
Just the grass.
It's not a weedner. It's the...
That was good.
You're on a roll.
Co-chair Greenlick, co-chair Kinnemer, and members of the committee, I'm Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, which is mid-Multnomah County and Happy Valley. And for some reason, I have become the primary cemetery guy in the Senate. I don't know if they think I have one foot in the grave because I've been around here so long, but I've ended up carrying a number of bills that have to do with cemeteries. Virtually all of them have been, at least in the Senate, non-controversial. In fact, Senate Bill 31 passed out of the committee and the floor of the Senate unanimously. There's a couple of things that this bill does. The primary thing is it's reacting to changes in behavior. 25 years ago, when grandma or grandpa died, they were buried. Today, in Oregon, 75% of the time, there's cremation. With cremation, it's pretty easy to divide remains. And so what we often have is a situation where a widow may divide the cremated remains of her husband among her children, perhaps three or four different ways. Under current law, for any of those children to dispose of any of those portions of the remains in a crypt or a cemetery vault, they have to get the permission of the mother. Now, obviously, they might decide to do this several years after Papa's gone. And in fact, in the meantime, Mama might die too. And this makes for a real difficult situation in terms of who has jurisdiction. And this bill, Senate Bill 31, would say that the person who has been granted the portion of the remains has the jurisdiction, and they, in fact, can inter those remaining remains in a crypt or vault or however they want to do it. That's one of the things this bill does. The second thing it does is there's a problem, some people taking cremated remains and just dumping them on a grave or, pouring them next to great-grandfather's headstone or something of that nature. This bill would allow the cemetery then to clean up any illegally dumped remains. That's basically what the bill does, those two things. Margaret's here from the Cemetery Association, and she probably knows a lot more about this stuff than I do, but I wanted to come in and let you know that this bill had no problems in the Senate. And it fixes what is a relatively minor problem, but could be an increasing problem. Cemetery associations that don't follow the law could be subject to lawsuit. That hasn't happened yet. So this, you might say, is preventative. I'm one that, not being an attorney myself, am never looking to make work for lawyers. And so when we can act preventatively to prevent lawsuits, we live in a litigious society, I like to try and do that. So I would hope that you will act favorably on this legislation. I'd be happy to respond to questions, or Margaret would be happy to respond to questions.
Margaret, why don't you say if you have something you want to say, and then we'll open for questions.
Yep. For the record, it's Michelle Gaines.
Michelle.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I followed his bad lead.
Close.
anything with an M on it.
Careful not to do that, Michelle.
Yes. Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and I think that when I look at this, it gets a little bit confusing for me. So the way I've simplified it is that through the nuances of law, there is one instance where, in essence, final disposition or a death can happen twice. Because final disposition can be burial or cremation, and because typically burial has always been in the cemetery, if cremated remains that have already been converted from human remains to personal property at that point of final disposition in the cremation chamber are then brought back to a cemetery, because of the way the law is written, they in essence turn back into human remains for the purposes of applying the laws around final disposition and who gets to control that. And it's because of that redundancy in the law that these problems have been created. We do get a lot of questions and confusion about this from consumers, from families that are having to deal with death and some of the conflict that sometimes does occur, and also from practitioners. And I can certainly answer any other questions that the members may have.
Does this bill do something, change that redundancy, or is it just a fix for the fact that it is redundant?
Chair Green, yes, it does. It does change it so that it's made clear that anybody in possession of cremated remains, that stays personal property, even if that's brought onto cemetery property. Now it magically turns back into human remains under current law.
Good. Are there any questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you very much for your time.
Stick around and you'll see it pass.
Good.
I close the public hearing. No, it is a work session.
Yes.
Yep.
Open the work session.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 31 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson moves Senate Bill 31. Representative
Thompson. Thompson. We're doing well.
Senate Bill 31.
Whoa. It isn't even Friday.
Senators are always a bad influence. I've helped create that problem. Thank you.
With the people in the room, I'm not going to make a disparaging remark about senators, but, you know.
No, but you can make disparaging remarks about ex-senators.
That's well, sure. That's
he
different.
Has the title, so
it's different.
It's legal.
Is there any discussion?
Representative Perry. I appreciate that this bill came forward, you know, and I won't even tell you how we said we're going to dispose of my mother-in-law at some point. I think that there's clearly an issue.
You should wait till she dies.
We've got it all fleshed out. We've got the containers and everything. I have some concern, though, about the legislature picking and choosing who gets better liability coverage. And there's a lot of industries out there that would like to have limited liability. And I don't think picking and choosing based on one industry with one problem is a good policy as folks who are trying to help or hinder business community. There's there's probably coverage I'd like to have liability for my business, and I'm sure doctors would like to have some additional liability breaks in their world, too. We have uncapped malpractice.
We're working on that.
What have you. So liability is an interesting thing, and for us to pick and choose who we're going to assign and give better umbrella coverage to, I'm not okay with. So while I appreciate the concern in the bill, if this wasn't just about liability as a piece of it, a big piece of it, quite frankly, for one industry, I could probably yes with how do we assign who gets which piece and parts of grandma. I've got three kids. They're going to have to solve who gets how much of their parents and what containers they're going to go in. But just to say we're going to, you know, we like an industry, we're going to give you blanket coverage or better coverage for liability, I think is a mistake to walk down that path.
Senator Parrish, is there anything in the bill about liability?
Provides that cemetery authority is not liable for disposition. So, yeah, it's right there in the summary, and it is in the bill. We actually heard that in the public hearing the last time, the folks who came and presented and had their hearing.
I knew they were worried about being liable if something screwed up, but I don't think the bill gives them.
Does it right there in the summary, and I'll try and figure out where it's in here.
Yeah, find it in the bill.
I think, if I may.
And Representative Wider.
Mr. Chair, I think they're trying to avoid a problem of remains being spread on somebody if they go out there with a lawnmower or whatever and they're blown in other places or they're out there with the leaf blower, things like that. It's not something I really feel comfortable talking about, and I realized reminds me of a country song and where I should be, and that's better off in a pine box, so rather than being spread across the top of the cemetery. But that's what this is about, is just the guys who own the cemetery, when they're out there doing cleanup and everything, if the ashes disappear, they're not liable that they disappeared. So,
and it is on page 4, line 16.
Line 12 through 15, too.
Yeah, well, specifically, a cemetery authority is not liable in any civil or criminal action relating to cremated remains. That's pretty clear right there. We're giving liability coverage to an industry. And I don't say that that's not a problem, but do you go clean up a grave when somebody has trespassed, essentially, then onto private property and scattered a piece of grandma onto grandpa's grave, that they're not causing harm there? But again, language that says we're going to give liability to one industry over another, when we don't do that with industries that may or may not spill something the wrong way on the sidewalk, I'm not okay with that. So that's just
my understanding of what this does, and maybe we'll ask Michelle back. What this does is it allows them to clean it up, and now they're not allowed to because it's remains, and they treat this as it's not remains, so they can
put it
in the garbage. Is that Michelle, will you?
But if somebody trespasses and scatters that, whether they're remains or not, they've trespassed and then they've put something there inappropriately, I think the onus is on the person who trespasses. I'm not a lawyer, but again, I have concerns about what this means.
Well, my understanding, and if you check it, right now, if somebody trespasses and scatters remains, they are defined as remains, and the cemetery people has to treat them as remains, not as litter. Is that right?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Parrish, that is part of it. There is also an equivalent limitation, and I am not a lawyer either, but there is a limitation right now that applies to cremated remains in that if there is no one there to claim them, that the person in possession of those cremated remains is not liable for the disposition, whether it's through cleanup or other form of disposal. If there's no one there to tell them otherwise, they're not held accountable.
So if I go to the city park or the public beach and I scatter grandma at the park bench and the guy comes and cleans that up, I mean, does he have liability, too, because now he's on government property where we're scattering remains? I don't see where the liability issue comes into play. And, again, I really wish we had a lawyer on this committee who could explain this to me, but I read it, and it screams red flag. If that section was gone, I could probably get there to yes on this, but I don't like the carving out liability protections for one industry over another. So I won't make a huge deal of it. I am
going
to know. But
any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Boyle? Okay, I'm Central 31. 31. Cremation.
Aye.
Aye.
Weidner?
Aye.
Weidner
Hanna? Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Green?
Aye. Bill passes. We need a carrier. Is that Kinnemer? You got it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 31 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 94. We have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 94.
I think, do we need the bill on the floor first to have any amendments?
No.
No? Okay. We have the Dash. We have a motion from Representative Weidner to move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 94. Is there any discussion? Yes, sir?
The reason I'm moving these is I've had lots of conversations outside of the building with people that aren't in the political world and friends that are doctors and dentists, and just kind of went through some of the problems and issues that they have. And the Dash 5s kind of go into some of the things that they've ran into that the task force could do. But a buddy of mine who is a dentist, he was telling me about, like, if he did a root canal on somebody, he would send off the payment for it, or that he had done the root canal, the insurance company would ask him then, hey, give us a description on it. So he writes up a description, and he'll send the x-ray with it, and they'll say, why'd you send us the x-ray? We didn't need an x-ray, and they send it back. And then they'll call him 2 weeks later and ask him to send the x-ray after he'd already sent it to him, and they just kind of drag out the reimbursement process on that, and the dash fives kind of go into that, or to look into those type of things, and that's why I'm moving the dash fives to go with Senate Bill 94.
Is there any other discussion? Would you call the roll?
Representative
Parrish? Yes. Yes. Sorry. Representative Boyle?
No.
Representative Weiner? Aye. Vice Chair Hanover?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee? No. Motion fails. Have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, may I?
You're on the board, or I've called Representative Thompson.
You ready for a moment?
Yes, please.
Co-Chair Greenlee, I move Senate Bill 94A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 94A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Widener?
Could we have a brief recess?
No. If there's a motion on the floor, we're going to go with the motion.
So,
is there any other discussion?
I think under the rules,
it's under my gavel, and I didn't recognize that motion. There's a bill on the floor.
If I
don't
may then.
Take the use to behave that way. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Under discussion?
Yep.
I think we're missing a big piece of the pie in one of the issues by not adopting these. I think if we had the OMA or ONA come up here and testify with some of the issues and stuff with the amendments I brought forward, I think they would be in strong support with the way it is now. I would rather us not move this and hold it over to an interim work group. So for that, I probably will not be supporting Senate Bill 94.
Great. Any other discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Jordy?
Yes.
Representative
Parrish?
No.
Representative
Boyle? Aye. Representative Weiner? No.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kilmer?
Excused.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Carrier?
You want to carry it?
Yeah, I guess.
Representative Thompson will carry it on the floor. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 94. In case anybody's here to talk about Senate Bill 99, let me just say we're not going to open Senate Bill 99 today. We seem to be at a place where one significant group of advocates want Senate Bill 99, only want it without the dash 14 amendments, and one significant group of advocates only want it with the dash 14 amendments. So at the moment, we're in this impasse, and maybe we'll get out of it, and maybe we'll wait for President Obama to give us an exchange. We'll see how that goes. So 99 is not going to be open today, if anybody is here just for that. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 93.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 93 is clarifying that providers must make a responsible effort to collect charges and expenses that relate to law enforcement activities from an individual and any responsible third-party payer before billing the Law Enforcement Medical Liability Account, also known as LEMLA, or a local correctional facility. It defines the responsibility of the third-party payer, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and you should have a fiscal impact statement that came over from the Senate that just basically clarifies that it's indeterminate and that there's no real fiscal impact at this point. It left the Senate floor with 30 ayes.
Okay.
Copy that.
Who do we have?
We have
Sean Jacobson from the Oregon Health Authority. Tell us why we have this bill.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Jacobson. I'm Interim Controller of the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to give you very brief testimony on Senate Bill 93A. The Law Enforcement Medical Liability Account, also known as LEMLA, was established in 1991 as a means of reimbursing medical service providers for uncompensated costs that are incurred when an individual is injured as a result of law enforcement activity. These are injuries that occur when law enforcement is attempting to restrain, detain, or take custody of an individual. Injuries usually are things like dog bites, taser, and gunshot wounds. The LEMLA is not funded out of state general fund, but rather out of assessments added to judiciary fines and bail forfeitures. The claims are paid out of the account after a medical service provider has made a reasonable attempt to bill the individual and their insurance provider. In order to be reimbursed out of LEMLA, the medical service provider completes a simple claim form, forwards it to the local law enforcement agency who does the certification that it was due to their actions. The law enforcement agency then forwards the claim to the department for payment. We process right now about 300 claims per year. The intent of Senate Bill 93 is to clarify the language in the statute requiring the medical service provider to bill the individual and the individual's insurance provider in advance of making a claim against LEMLA. This is not a change in policy, and there's no fiscal impact associated with this bill, and there's really no known cases of noncompliance with the current process. However, the language in the statute is not as clear as we would like. The proposed language is to do a cleanup to clarify that the LEMLA account would be the payer of last resort. The statute does require us to file an annual report, a LEMLA budget report, to the Judiciary Committee. We can make that available if you're interested on the finance associated with this account. It is relatively a small account. The balance today, I think, is less than $300,000 in it. I will really close my testimony there, see if you have any questions about this program. I'd be happy to address them.
Are there questions? Mm-hmm. Why should the health insurance payer or the person themselves pay for an expense that was caused by law enforcement action?
Co-Chair Greenlee, unfortunately, I am not with a law enforcement entity, and so the policy decisions as to why this policy decision was made, I can't say. It was established in 1991, and we are the administrator of the program.
You're saying it's in statute now? This doesn't change the policy?
Correct. Excuse me. The statutory change is clarifying that right now it says, pull the language for you, reasonable efforts to collect charges and expenses means a provider has billed the individual for whom the medical service were provided for or the insurer or health care service contractor of the individual before seeking to collect from the keeper of the local correctional facility. What we've done is we've changed that or to an and to ensure that there's due diligence that we've attempted to collect in advance of claiming against LEMLA. Hmm.
Does that perplex anybody else here?
It sounds like they don't have any way to pay anyway.
Hmm. So you're saying there's already a policy, and that's that if I get tasered by a police department, then I need to charge my insurance for that expense, even if it wasn't anything I did that caused it to happen.
I'm sorry, Coach, let me clarify. This is in pursuit of, so the individual is fleeing from law enforcement, and law enforcement at that point in the fleeing is attempting to restrain them, detain them.
Okay.
So it is when they're fleeing from law enforcement.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Where does the funding come from? You said there's $300,000 in this account? It's not a very big insurance fund. Where does it come? If I'm going to sue somebody, I want to sue somebody with deep pockets, and you're not it.
Co-Chair Thompson, this is it's a fee. It's an assessment that's added right now to bail forfeiture.
Okay.
And the funding mechanism is being reviewed right now. So.
Russ, what do you think? We have a
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'm not quite ready to go into work session. I just haven't done my homework. I'm sorry, I don't even have questions prepared to ask you today, but I do want to understand. I'm new to this program. I do want to understand it a little better before voting on it. So
I think that's good.
I recommend not moving into work session.
And if you can do anything to help our members get a better understanding of this before we move into work session, that would be very helpful.
Absolutely. We'd be happy to.
And then we'll take the responsibility to actually read the bill, which is our responsibility. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 93A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 573. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, what we have is, once I can get to it, Senate Bill 573A comes to you from the Senate side with 20 ayes, 9 nays. It prohibits health insurers from demanding a refund of payment made to satisfy the claim of a health care provider on or before an earlier of the date specified in the contract with the provider or 9 months after the date of payment. It increases from 6 months after the provider has received the written request from the health insurance to 24 months after the provider has received such a request of the amount of that time that the health insurer may request a contested refund to be paid. There are some A4s, but I discovered right after lunch that those are basically being replaced by an amendment that we have yet to receive, but we have folks here to testify on that.
Tell us what they're planning on doing.
They will have to tell you because I'm not sure what the new ones were. I could tell you what the old ones were, but I'm not sure on the new.
All right. Let's have Rose Cox, Keisha Redden, is it? Redden, R-E-R, great. Keisha Redden, and Gwen Dayton is the first panel.
Excuse me, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. My name is Rose Cox, and I'm here representing the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association in support of Senate Bill 573. As you heard, this bill changes current law where insurance companies are allowed to ask for a refund of a paid claim up to 2 years after they pay that claim. This bill would put that time period to 9 months. The original bill, we had a six-month period where they could ask for a refund, and after working with the insurers some, we're trying to get a little bit closer with them. I don't think we're ever going to be exactly on the same page, but we did move to 9 months for the request, and they had requested the 24-month language about making sure to negotiate how much the refund's going to be, getting the claim paid and whatnot. Very briefly, refunds happen. It's part of life. Sometimes insurers don't realize that a person that they think is covered hasn't paid their premium. That's okay. We just need a reasonable timeline for when these refunds happen. There's plenty of due diligence done by providers before they even submit claims to insurers to ensure that the person they are submitting the claim to is the payer of record, as opposed to work comp, personal injury protection under motor vehicle accident insurance, or another payer. We do know that comp has to be filed within 60 days, and with everything being computerized and having technology, we feel that 9 months is more than enough time to realize who the payer of record needs to be.
And incidentally, if somebody will tell us who those next amendments are coming from and what they are.
The
okay,
element.
Gwen will. Good. Yes.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, committee members, My name is Keisha Raritan, and I'm here to give testimony on Senate Bill 573. I'm a registered nurse and the administrator of Northwest Ambulatory Surgery Center. I would like to just review quickly the process with you on the due diligence that is done prior to a patient having surgery. Once we receive the schedule from the surgeon's office, we immediately start gathering information related to the insurance through the patient and through the insurance company. We specifically ask the insurance company what the benefits are for that patient, and then we ask them if pre-authorization is needed for that particular procedure. We schedule the procedure, perform it, and we usually have them billed within 5 days. At that point, the majority of insurance companies are requiring the patients to fill out an accident questionnaire before they will reimburse the surgery center so that they can make sure that it is not a workers' comp claim or a motor vehicle accident. We are not allowed to give the patients that questionnaire. It has to come through the insurance company. What we end up doing then is just calling the patient repeatedly to ask them to complete the questionnaire. Once the reimbursement is finally received by the surgery center, it's usually a time frame of 30 to 60 days. Then at that point, we can start to see refund requests up to 2 years afterwards. On average, I receive 5 refund requests from insurance companies a month for various reasons. Sometimes they'll say that the procedure wasn't pre-authorized. They've already paid me for it, but now they're deciding it wasn't pre-authorized. Sometimes they'll say the coordination of benefits wasn't correct, even though they told me that the patient was covered. Sometimes they will say they paid incorrectly, but they won't explain to me what incorrectly means. Like Rose said, we understand that there are some legitimate reasons for refund requests, but what we're saying is, in this day and age, it should not take up to 2 years to determine whether a procedure was reimbursed correctly. And for small businesses, we can't afford to operate at that level of inefficiency, and we're asking that the insurance companies ask for the request in a timely fashion, and we think 9 months is more than fair enough. Thank you.
Excuse me, Co-Chair Greenlink and Thompson. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association, and sorry, sounds like I've got some sort of Kathleen Turner voice today, but we strongly support the bill as it arrives on your desk today. We support the A.N. Gross version of Senate Bill 573 for all the reasons that you've heard. We think that 9 months is fair for both providers and for insurers, and we support that. But we also have another amendment we would like to put forward that is related to this. It relates to refunds. It's kind of on the other end. When an insurer has requested a refund, commonly another insurer is the actual lawful payer. So, for example, somebody comes in transitioning from one insurance to another, they're changing jobs or whatever, and they have a procedure done, and they hand over their insurance card for their insurance A. Turns out, actually, insurance B is the one who ought to be paying the tab because they'd already transitioned over to the second insurer. Okay. Insurer A lawfully, rightfully asked for a refund. They weren't the right payer. The provider now needs to bill insurer B. But the problem is that if the insurer A doesn't ask for the refund soon enough, often the provider has missed the timely filing deadline for insurer B. So then they just don't get any money for it. So that's what we're trying to address. Lori Freeman at LC and I have been talking extensively about the wording of the amendment, and I think we have it crafted. The wording that we submitted to Lori and that I think she generally agrees is correct is included in my written testimony. It basically says that the provider will have 9 months after a refund is requested to bill the next insurer. Just build in a time frame for them to an appropriate, we think, time frame for the provider, the physician, to be able to bill the second insurer and receive lawful payment. That's what it is, and we appreciate Ms. Freeman's work on it. We appreciate the committee considering it.
Questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm just trying to understand the bill. So some different kind of scenarios one can imagine. One is that an insurer determines that they have overpaid, right? They've overpaid the provider. Somebody missed a premium. They, in fact, weren't covered. So in that case, they are requesting a refund from the provider of the overpayment. And under this bill, they would need to do that within 6 months, 9 months. So there's another scenario, which is that the provider needs to... that the overpayment is the other direction? What's the 24-month? How are we... help me understand why we've got 6 months in one place, or 9 months in one place and 24 months in another.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Cannon. That was something that during our negotiation with the insurance companies, they wanted to ensure was in there to make sure. So the 9 months is really just an initial notification.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your date of payment, which mm-hmm. could be a couple months after the actual procedure mm-hmm. or visit. You have date of payment, 9 months to say, hey, we think something may be wrong here. It doesn't have to be set in stone of you owe us $247.32. It can say we just know we've overpaid you.
Uh-huh.
The 24-month period is to say that you have an additional 15 months after you give notification to negotiate and make sure that you understand that you know the payment's the right amount. So you can have the notification within 9 months, but then, you know, 3 months after notification, you can say, okay, so now we know exactly how much it is. You just have to notify. And I believe Gwen can speak to this as well.
Sure. Judge Greenlee Thompson, Representative Cannon. I think you see the 9 months and you see 24 months. 9 months is the time frame to notify that we need a refund. But if the amount is not clear, either the amount is not clear or you dispute the rationale for the refund itself, then you've got more time to work it out. That's essentially what that more extended time period is about.
Let's say that that there is a dispute over the amount and the clock starts to run on the 24 months. Does this provide that after 24 months, the provider no longer is responsible for making for refunding the payment? Is that what we're attempting to establish with this bill?
Chair Screen, Lincoln Thompson, Representative Cannon, no. It's just to put a time frame on when the dispute has to be settled within. So people can't just let it go and let it go and let it go.
But what if it's not? Is a question.
I don't know.
Chair Screenlick and Thompson, co-vice chair Cannon.
Excuse
me. My reading of this is it requires that the insurer must request that a contested refund be paid. May not request that a refund be paid later than 24 months after the provider's received written notice. So if at 24 months there is no request for refund, then the insurer has lost their opportunity for that. I see your point that if you get to 23 months and you're running out of time, I think at that point the insurers will have to decide how they would elect to proceed on that basis, but I think they would request the refund at that point. I mean, they would just have to because their time is running out to work it out.
You've confused me now.
Awesome.
What's the 9 months then?
Co-Chair Greenlee, the 9 months is the time to request a refund. If it's contested, there's more time than to work out the area of dispute, be it the amount or the reason.
And the same question, Gwen, what happens after 24 months? It's not resolved.
Can I answer that?
Anybody?
Co-Chair Greenlee, Representative Ken. That is not the... I personally, in running our surgery center for the last 6 years, have never run into that 24 limit. The premise of the bill is that it's that initial request from the insurance company to refund. And what we're saying is why we're asking for that to be less time is because the longer the time frame goes from the date of surgery to when whoever has been determined to be responsible for paying that, if that ends up becoming actually the patient's responsibility, every month that goes by that has passed since that surgery occurred, you have a less and less chance of actually getting paid for it.
Let me see if I can pay, and then you can try again after me.
I understand perfectly. Within 9 months, you have to say, oh, we're going to ask you for a refund. And within 24 months, we have to have collected the refund, or we haven't collected the refund. What happens at that point if either you have, or you have, I mean, if you have, then it's fine. But if you haven't, does the claim go away? Is that's the question.
Coach Greenlick, I understand what you're saying now. So that was not our intent to
what
say.
What is your intent?
Just that
what
it
happens
that it,
in 24
that it,
months.
That it should be all finished within 24
be.
Months.
Okay.
That
so,
any.
So why don't we just say into the law that it would be really nice if you guys can do it within 24 months. That would be a good statute, right?
Well,
you know,
and to be honest,
be
this
mean.
May be a better question really for the insurers because this was their language that they requested from us. So that may be a question for them as to why they wanted that in there.
Thank you very much. Are there any
other
questions
to
this panel? We'll get another panel and see what thank you. Tom Holt. Elise Brown.
And Lisa Trussell.
Did I miss somebody?
Yes, you did.
Oh, yeah. Lisa Trussell. Maybe you guys can tell us what happens in 24 months.
Yeah.
Jim, will you take over? I need to see Rick about tonight.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson. And members of the committee, Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and thank you for allowing me to be here this afternoon. My comments will be in opposition to Senate Bill 572. Three. Reconciliation of claims is an important fiscal duty for plans and providers. Most financial records are calculated on an annual basis, either by policy or by plan year. The vast majority of plan years are a period of 12 months. Additionally, most reconciliations include a three-month period after the end of the plan year to allow for claim runout period. To prohibit reconciliation of a mispaid claim, either overpayment or underpayment, less than 12 months would hinder both providers and health plans from providing for accurate payment. Essentially, then, both plans and providers would have to live with whatever inadvertent errors occurred during that year. Most importantly, changes made to payment reconciliations, such as those suggested in 573, should be reciprocal. Just last session, at the request of OMA, the time frame that was negotiated, 24 months, were equitable, placed on both providers to recoup payments, underpayments, and for plans to recoup overpayments. We believe that standard accounting practices call for a longer period of time than 9 months and believe that at a minimum of at least 12 would be more preferably appropriate to ensure that plans have the time to appropriately and accurately balance their books in a fiscal way. I have a couple of my AHIP members with me today, Tom Holt with Regents and Lisa Trussell with HealthNet, to provide, expand, and answer questions.
Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon here in opposition to Senate Bill 573. Before I get into the substance, I just want to put on the record, there have not been any substantive negotiations on this bill on this side. Our last conversations with the proponents were that we would have conversations about these timelines on the House side. Those have not occurred since it came out of the Senate committee. I think that's important to correct for the record. This bill is premature, inequitable, and it's potentially quite costly. As Elise said, the most recent change to the statute was just out of last session. We've had barely a year of actual implementation of that statute. We, in fact, just filed our most recent report for the past year with the insurance division in regard to prompt payment. We have to report statistics about that to the insurance division. We are required by law to pay all clean claims within 30 days. And so that gives you some idea of how short we feel this is since this last was looked at to be able to make any assessment about the impact of the most recent change to the law. There was no attempt by the ASCs to approach us prior to session to discuss whether this was working or not for them. There's a huge inequity in this bill. It shortens the timeline at which we can recoup refunds when we inadvertently overpay a provider for a variety of reasons. It may be because a person turned out not to be covered. There could be a number of other reasons why a claim would turn out not to be valid. While at the same time leaving in place for their convenience 2 years to ask us for money. Meanwhile, what goes on in the background in the private sector is that large groups certainly and others contract with auditors who come in or if they have the capability themselves, audit their claims. And they typically do a one-year look back because they look at plan years. Usually it's a calendar year. So those look backs occur a year or so after a claim is filed, and then we have to work out with the customer who really was responsible to pay. Sometimes that turns out to be another carrier. Unfortunately, there is not perfect information sharing amongst carriers. It's simply not possible with the large number of claims that get processed to get it 100% right. It is at the beginning, although everything is highly automated, once it's into the computers, it works pretty well. This all is a human institution, and a provider may code something incorrectly. Something may be entered incorrectly on our end once in a blue moon. You know, these things do occur in a relatively small number of claims, but those where it does occur, it's a fairly significant process, and there's a lot of complexity to getting it worked out. What we would be likely to have to do if this bill were to pass in its current form would be to impose more of what none of us want to see, more prior authorization processes to make sure that the claims are going to go through and that they are for a covered person. We would probably have to make adjustments in how we deal with providers to account for the additional costs that the bill would cause. And it would probably be reflected eventually in premiums. And it's important to remember that these dollars are not our dollars or the doctor's dollars. They are the dollars that belong initially to our members who pay the premium. And it's our job as stewards of that premium to make sure that the right people get paid the right amount and to get these things worked out over a period of time. I would also suggest, since they are subject to all the same statutes as small group and individual markets, that PEB and OEB be inquired as to the impact on their benefit plans. There is probably a cost on them, and DCBS may be able to help inform the process in regard to what the condition is of prompt payment at this point, with reports having recently gone in. Now, all that said, we're not wedded to the 2 years. That was a number that seemed reasonable, I'm told, last session to everyone involved, the OMA and to insurers. And the agreement, I believe, was to see how that works. But we haven't really had time enough to analyze how it is working. And we're taking a real risk if we were to shorten that up at this point. So our practical suggestion here would be to kick this to the interim, by which time we should be able to get better data. And we would certainly make the commitment to sit down with the medical community and look at that data and see if this is working or not. With that, I'll close.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell, representing Health Plan of Oregon, and I just briefly want to comment. We also are opposed to Senate Bill 573 for the reasons that have been indicated by Elise and Tom, but I just want to remind the committee that prior to last session, Senate Bill 508, timelines were non-existent. It was done through your contracts with providers. So the fact that we went to 2 years and then for non-contracted providers, and that is a step. And as Tom said, we haven't had enough history with this new law to see what the impact has been. And it's my understanding today from my folks in Tigard that Medicare rebalances for up to 7 years. So 24 may not be the right number, but 9 months is obviously pretty a crunch timeline to make an adjustment in. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might be Tom or Lisa, any one of you who want to touch this one. How can we look at simplifying these codes for all these different insurance companies for the billing? because that's one of the issues is how it gets coded or put in. You're talking about somebody making a simple mistake here or there, and then that holds up the claims and the payment process and everything on it. And it seems like we're making things too complicated rather than looking at ways of making it easier. And I don't know if that's something that insurance companies look at doing or if you guys look at making it more complicated for the doctors. But then I know that the other issue we have on the other side is hospitals not getting reimbursed very much by Medicaid, Medicare, and then we start sending around so they can get all kinds of treatment and stuff since we don't have liability reform or anything like that, to where they're going out and running up the cost on you guys too, because we're not reimbursing properly because for some reason as a state we don't want to give doctors liability reform and we don't want to increase our reimbursement rates. So you guys get screwed on that end by us, yet then on the other hand you're kind of messing with the doctors with your billing on that side to make sure they're where they're at. How do we fix this?
Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, I wish I knew. But more to the point, the coding is determined at a national level. There's a committee, which I understand includes stakeholders, operated by the American Medical Association that comes up with the code list of all the ICD codes, the diagnostic codes that go with each procedure that then enable us to determine the billing. So it's a much bigger issue than anything I think we can address here, although we're trying to take steps through capitated kind of systems. But even within a capitated kind of system, you still have to have the detail underneath that to know whether or not the capitation is appropriate and if it's working or not. So I don't have an easy answer for you on that, unfortunately. If I did, I probably wouldn't be here. I'd be on a beach in Tahiti or something enjoying my wealth.
Well, and Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Widener, I think that also part of the work, what we can do, is there are national standards, and I think we're in the process of adopting a new one for January 1st. And then the other thing is that through the admin simplification that's been occurring, we're tackling, codes separately. I think that there's a plan to do 5 codes, and we've done 2 of them that are is also going to go into effect in January. And then also part of the federal health care reform bill was to have an admin simplification and try to get some more consistency on codes. So I think that it's recognized as an issue, but there's different aspects that are addressing how to synchronize all the different codes.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify something. I think the Medicare reconciliation you're talking about is reconciliation on who's a member of a Medicare Advantage group and who's not.
Maybe.
I don't think it's on a single claim.
I'm not sure. I just, when this bill came up, they were saying Medicare was 7 years.
Maybe you can help us on the bill we had before. If I'm insured by you, and I'm running away from a cop and get tasered and break my nose. Is my insurance going to cover that? Or are there exclusions for that sort of thing? Like, I mean, we had this with the substance abuse treatment payment around court things. And I wonder whether, are those things excluded in your policies? Do you have any idea? Or maybe you can get us some more.
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, we have in our contracts that we do not cover the injuries that arise from law enforcement activity.
So asking a person to try and collect from you first is sort of meaningless because you're not going to pay.
Co-Chair Greenlick, I can only speak to our policies, and let me clarify. If you were, going with a green light and a police car with its sirens on is going the other way and T-bones you, that's a different thing. We would cover that.
We're going to be in the traffic.
Yeah, but if you're running away from the police and then have a claim or you get in a fight with a policeman, we're not going to pay for lawbreakers. Our premium payers aren't going to.
That's helpful for discussion. Yes.
Is that actually specifically excluded? Because again, and this did come up in a separate hearing, but my understanding is we don't pay for people who are inmates who are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. But is that really specifically excluded? Because I've never gone to the hospital and been asked, did I receive my injuries while committing a crime? And, you know, I'll plead the fifth on whether or not I got those injuries in that way, but at the end of the day,
not even necessarily committing a crime. In this case, it would be fleeing pursuit.
Well, I've never been asked that either.
Co-Chair Greenlink, Representative Hoyle, the specific language in our contracts is that we don't cover injuries arising from violation of law. And, you know, to your point, though, I mean, the most important thing when someone does show up injured is that they get taken care of and we sort out the claim later. And sometimes that takes
2 years.
2 years.
We wouldn't mind if we get Senate Bill 93 back up on the agenda, if we could get some clarification of what is covered in policies. That would be very helpful if you...
I made a note to check because was fascinated with the tasing aspect.
So were we.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Yes, sir.
On this bill, I'm not sure how to ask this question other than bluntly, and I'd ask it of the previous group as well in time. Is this something that we could move to an interim work group? I'm sensing this is a very convoluted, colliding business systems issue that maybe doesn't lend itself to a straight up or down vote. Would we gain something, in your opinion, from having a further discussion on this prior to a bill?
Co-Chair Greenlink, Co-Chair Thompson, yes, and we'd be very agreeable to having that kind of discussion in the interim on the assumption that we think we would have a great deal more data to work from.
And co-chairs, to add to that too, I think particularly in light of the fact that we did have an agreement last session on the 24-month time frame, and we have yet to see the results of that. So
I'm thinking that with our new system, it isn't that long to the next session. Certainly not 2 years. This might be something we could clarify a lot more detail. And,
well, there was a work group, right? That got it to the last bill.
During the last legislative session, Mr. Co-Chair.
I wonder if we could reconvene that group and have it. Would that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just thinking this may not be a straight up or down issue. Looks a little convoluted. And
we explore that, Mr. Co-Chair?
Fine, yeah. We ask everybody the same question. But.
Well, one other thing, looking at that, I mean, how many times, I mean, well, never mind. I'm going back to the other bill, so I won't waste your time.
Okay.
Never mind.
One bill at a time. We have one more requested witness. Let's get that. And I think we have some interest in reconvening the group. Was that Senate Bill 508? Was that the bill?
Yeah, fine.
The Senate Bill 508 work group, getting them back. And
I'll check it out.
Yeah. And Sandy will do that further.
I'm sensing we might not have gotten it quite right.
Well, let's find out. Yeah. Who do I have? I had David Schlachtis. You're up.
Co-Chair Greenlink, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Hope Orthopedics of Oregon, both here in Salem. So I'm representing surgery centers and also independent physicians as well. I don't want to spend a lot of time repeating what all the other people have said. I would just like to paint a perspective so that when you move forward, you have sort of the perspective of how this affects surgery centers, hospitals, and physicians. And I'm going to start with considering it. I ask you to consider two things. One is the patient perspective. So you come in, you come to a doctor, he says you need surgery. We get, as Rose and Keisha said, we do all the due diligence. We find out, yes, you're authorized. We go ahead and do the surgery. But for whatever reason, we don't bill you, the patient, for 2 years. Then we send you a bill at the end of 2 years. You're going to be pretty upset, to say the least. That's sort of what this is. we've done our due diligence. We've done everything we're supposed to do. We got authorization, because if they say no, we don't do it. We're not going to unknowingly do a surgery. There are times when we do surgeries and we know we're not going to get paid, and we make that conscious decision to do it anyway because it's in the best interest of the patients and the community. But if we're going to get paid, then we should get paid. And and if we were going to come to you as an individual and say, oh, 2 years later, sorry, we forgot to bill you, now you owe us money, you'd be incredibly upset. So the perspective is, you also have to understand the numbers that we're talking about. When you go back to a hospital and you say, oops, we want an $80,000 refund, that's not a small number. When you come to a surgery center and you want a $20,000 refund from me, and I've signed checks for $20,000 to the insurance company for a refund, that's not a small check. When you go to an independent solo practitioner, a primary care doc who is solo out in the hinterlands of Oregon, and they're barely making it, and the insurance company says, oops, we want $1,000 back, that's not a small number. So this is in part a cash flow issue. I don't dislike insurance companies. They're important for our society. But I have to admit, I don't have a lot of sympathy for them. These people...
How many checks have you written back for claims that came in after 6 months?
I don't track personally when the refund was requested. If it was requested at 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 24 months, I can tell you that I sign on average 15 refund requests a month from the surgery center and about 20 a month for the individual private orthopedic practice.
Money going back to
insurance companies.
So it's a fairly frequent event.
Yes. And we also sign a lot more checks, which I am happy to do, of giving money back to the patient because of coordination of benefits and the patient did their due diligence. We have patients that will go out of their way and pay up front, knowing that eventually the insurance company stuff will get handed out. And I sign $5 checks back to them, and I'm happy to do it because it's their money and they deserve it back. It's not that the insurance company doesn't deserve it. I just think that we need to hold their feet to the fire to tell them, get your systems in order. We have to get our systems in order. You know, they said, well, we have 2 years to file a claim. Really? I'd like to see one of my contracts that says that. Every contract I have says that my timely filing is anywhere from 120 days to 1 year. And if I don't file it within 120 days or 1 year, whatever my contract says, insurance company can say, I don't have to pay it. So for them to say, well, it takes us 2 years to work this out, that's really not fair. I mean, that's really what the issue is. And, of course, then they were up here scaring you by saying, well, they're going to put more prior authorization on us. It's really hard for me to conceive of them putting more prior authorization on us than what we already do. We know what we need to do to get paid. We are so diligent because we don't want to be in that situation where we provide services and the insurance company says, you didn't get prior authorization, so we don't have to pay. So we go out of our way. If you break your hip tonight and you need surgery tomorrow, I guarantee you they will be on the phone making sure that it's prior authorized. Now, that's not a good example because that would be under an emergency situation. But if you decide, gosh, I really want this done next week because I'm going out of the country, we will move heaven and earth to make sure we get the proper authorization so that we will get paid and you don't have to be billed for any more than what is appropriate.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill... Senate Bill 573. Okay. And briefly open up public hearing on...
Brian has something to say?
Briefly open up public hearing...
I saw him start to rise
Senate
off the
Bill
floor.
Senate Bill 93.
Well,
573. Oh, 573. Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah.
You're right. Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 93.
and reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 573. It looked like S93, I thought.
You had that look when you sort of rose and down and up and down.
No, Ryan.
Something was happening.
It's you I was looking for.
Were you trying to write like a doctor?
I was. Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brian Behringer. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I apologize for quickly scribbling out the note. I just want to come up and add, there was a lot of discussion about some past agreements and some history and some negotiation. I want to plug in some information to fill in some of those blanks. Last session, the OMA did sponsor a bill, Senate Bill 508, to address this issue that you just heard about that we continue to struggle with. We worked diligently with our friends in the insurance industry to come up with a compromise that was indeed Senate Bill 508 that passed last session. We have some small problems with that bill, and that's sort of what we were asking for in our amendment. And we brought those changes back in another bill that was over on the Senate side, Senate Bill 231. That bill, unfortunately, was a casualty of time limits and of some continued negotiations with the insurers. And this bill, Senate Bill 537, is not an OMA bill. This is the ASC bill, and it has some different timelines in it. So I just want to make sure that everybody on the committee knows that the negotiations that happened in that work group were between OMA and the insurers and not the ASCs, and we are now trying to piggyback on the ASC bill to solve some of our problems. We have had a number of conversations with the insurers, and we'll probably continue to have those conversations as a result of this hearing. We're happy to do that. But I wanted to make it very clear that this bill, the 573, is the ASC's bill. Our bill was lost. We're trying to pin some of our fixes from our bill into this bill, but it's not our bill, and it wasn't what was negotiated last session.
Do you think in the time frame we have, you could get the ASC and the insurance companies together and come up with a compromise on this, or should we?
Well, speaking on behalf of OMA, we are happy.
You have about a week.
We are happy to do that, and I have always noted that the power of the legislative committee behind those work groups helps us come to agreement. But I can't speak for the ASCs because it is their bill, but we would be happy to do that.
Well, if you could get them all together and get this done by, let us know within a week, I think we, you know, we'll have to post final work sessions in about 10 days. So if you can, that'll save taking it into the in the interim. If you can come up with an agreement, that would be great.
Okay.
So why didn't you have a question?
Oh, no, I was just going to say probably out of hurry after I was tased and raped by the chair today. So
that's what happens when you attack. You may get retribution.
Figuratively.
Watch out when you attack a wild animal. Okay. Close the public session on Senate Bill 573. And is there anything else to bring before? It's like a recess now, Representative Wagner? I owe you one.
You're giving me one Friday.
Okay. I'm giving you all Friday.
Thank
I didn't
you.
Say I didn't enjoy it, though.
We are not in session on Friday. We have that day off.
Really?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah,
nobody
knew.
Yeah.
It was brought to you by your co-chair.
Harry knew, though.
It was an appreciation
when it
move.
Yes, it was Thompson. He gets credit for it.
Both of us.
My staff doesn't tell me that because then I go off and do other things this way. They
you
can
are
my
free time. Friday afternoon.
That is excellent.
If you let your staff be free.
We are adjourned.